So let me start with two very quick intros, okay? Intro number one is that I'm here like on, I guess you'd call it a speaking tour, and my whole trip was set up like a few months ago. I ran most of the places I'm speaking, and we spoke about even topics and stuff like that. And then, on Simchat Torah, the whole world turned upside down. And I wasn't sure even if I should come. It wasn't easy to leave Eretz Yisrael now, etc., but I felt it was important. The people here told me it's even more important, so I decided to come. I said, well, obviously, I have to change everything I'm going to talk about. I have to talk about things that are related to the current situation. So that's what I did, except in most cases, what I wound up changing was the title. And most of what I realized I was going to talk about is what I need to talk about, just, you know, packaged a little differently. Now, in this particular case, this was only set up afterwards, so I didn't actually have something set up for this, but I'll tell you why I chose the topic that I... Those who are in Tanakh, what's Sefer or Sfarim? How does it work? What are you learning?
It's not really a Sefer or Sfarim. It's mostly we're learning about Sforno in one class, and then in the other one we're doing the topics of heroes and villains.
The tears of heroes and villains.
Well, we've been doing Bereishis.
Bereishis, I see. Okay. All right, so we're going to look at Shoftim, Perek, Dalet, and Hay, which is the story of Dvorah and Barak and Sisra. But there are two, in the end, I chose this for two reasons, okay? So one is because in the end, I do think it's going to lead to a message that is very important right now. So that was one reason to choose it. But also because I think it illustrates something very important. Look, in general, the study of Tanakh was neglected for centuries. It's an interesting question why. But the fact is, Tanakh, particularly Nevi'im and Ketuvim, I mean, all you have to do is look at the number of commentaries that were written, let's say before the 19th century. The number of commentaries written on the Gemara, I never counted, but I imagine it's in the hundreds. The number of commentaries written on Chumash, I imagine is in the dozens. And on the, no? Yes? And in Nevi'im and Ketuvim, I'm not sure if we'd get to 10 before the 19th century. And if we get to 10, we certainly wouldn't get to 20. Okay? For whatever reason, people stopped studying Tanakh. And for most of history, it wasn't really studied. There's been a revolution in the study of Tanakh in the last generation or two. I come to you from ground zero of that revolution, from Alon Shvut. I've had the privilege, and that was my introduction to Tanakh also. I studied in Gush in 1986 for the first time. I studied with Rabbi Menachem Liebtag, who I still consider my teacher and friend. And after that, I studied with his teachers, with Rav Yoel Binun, with Rav Meidan, the Rosh Yeshiva now, who I'm also privileged to call my neighbors. Rav Meidan sits right behind me in shul. And if I mention him, either way, I should say that his son was very, very badly wounded, very, very badly wounded, very seriously wounded in Gaza last week. He needs a lot of tefillot to... he's now expected to survive. I think he lost two legs, though. So anyway, they all need our tefillot. Anyway, so and I've had the privilege to study with these people, and I think the question we have to ask is why the study of Tanakh specifically was reborn in this generation and in Israel. Why did it happen now? And I think there are two reasons for that. One reason, which I think is clear to everybody, and the second one, which is less clear, but I think it's at least as true. The first reason is because we're back in Israel, we're able to do what I love to do, which is to take the Tanakh and to go out, you know, b'shetach, you know, to study the Tanakh on location, which people want to do first and foremost because it's just incredibly emotionally powerful, right? To stand on top of a mountain or something and to say, this happened right here, we're standing where this happened. But it... And I'm not taking anything away from that. That's a very powerful experience, and it's a very meaningful experience. It's much deeper than that, though. There are things that we can understand so much better by simply looking, traveling the land, understanding the topography, the roads, the hills, the valleys. There are things that you just understand much better. And even more so when we add the modern fields of research that we now have access to, archaeology and history, etc., that, you know, give us so much more tools to understand the Tanakh. That's one reason. And most of that was facilitated by our return to Eretz Yisrael. There's also a second reason, though, which I think less people pay attention to, and that's that the messages of Tanakh are simply much more relevant now than they were for most of history. Much of Tanakh, and here I'm talking specifically about the Nevi'im, there are certain books of Tanakh that you know, perhaps are, you know, speak a lot to the individual, like Tehillim, for example. And in fact, Tehillim was more popular. I don't know how many people studied it, but people at least recited it. And maybe people studied it too. Tehillim, Mishlei, Kohelet, right? But the Nevi'im, most of their messages were talking not to individuals or communities, but to a nation. They speak about politics. They speak about government. They speak about how to get an entire nation to do the right thing and what happens when an entire nation does the wrong thing. And major processes like that. And how to deal with enemies, and how to deal with foreign influences and diplomacy. Stuff that we don't necessarily consider relating to our Torah sources, but, and for much of history, that stuff was simply not relevant to us. And today it is again. So, therefore, with that background, and maybe therefore that's at least one reason why people stopped studying Tanakh in exile, and why Tanakh study has kind of been reborn, dafke, not just in Eretz Yisrael, but in Medinat Yisrael. Okay. Therefore, with that quick background, which took longer than it should have, I chose this topic because I think both of these, this is a good example of both of those things. We're going to use it over here. I'll hand out now two maps. We'll see what they, we'll use them in a few minutes. But what I want to try to do is I want to try to, we're going to look at Shoftim, Perek Dalet, and Perek Hei. And we're going to try... first of all, to use some of what we now know, okay, the real way to do this would be to go up to the top of Har Tavor and to at least have part of this shir over there. That's what I love to do when I can. We don't have that opportunity today, but you're all invited when you come to Eretz Yisrael. But okay, what we know from being there and with the maps that we have, we're going to try to see what our understanding of Eretz Yisrael can do to help us understand what the Navi is telling us on a much deeper level, I hope. And as I said, I think there's going to be a message here that's relevant, not only in our generation, but specifically to the crisis that we currently find ourselves in. Okay? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to jump right in. We're not going to read every pasuk, but we're going to try to understand what's going on here. Okay. How many people have studied Sefer Shoftim? How many people study Sefer Shoftim later than fourth grade? Okay. All right. Your teacher probably drew a circle on the board, right, when you did Perek Ben, right? The cycle of Sefer Shoftim. What's the cycle? What? For either people do Avodah Zarah or other sins, usually Avodah Zarah, which leads to an enemy, which leads to tshuva, which leads to a shofet who saves them, and then everything comes out good for 40 years or so, or at least that's what it says, and then the cycle repeats. Okay, so that is exactly what the Sefer says in Perek Bet. If you study the Sefer on a deeper level, you realize that it's not really a cycle, it's really a downward spiral, and the cycle starts to break down also. It doesn't repeat itself. That's the whole point. It's kind of like in poetry. I remember when I took English Lit in YU, right? The teacher explained to us, there's like iambic pentameter or whatever it is. Like the whole point of it is that the poem doesn't always follow it, right? It sets like a standard and then things start deviating from it. Otherwise, or like the scale of music or something like that, right? The pattern isn't really a pattern. It's a pattern that breaks down as the Sefer goes on. But we're near the beginning of the Sefer still. Dvorah is like the third or fourth Shofet. So let's jump right in here. Vayosifu b'nei Yisrael asot hara b'nei Adonai ve'ehud met. Ehud being the, not the previous Shofet actually, but the most dominant one before. Vayimkereim Adonai b'yad yavin melech kenan asher malach b'chatzor. V'sar tzva'os sisra. Okay, so take a look at the map on the page that says Milchemet HaKishon, and you can see where Chatzor is, and you can see where Charoshet HaGoyim is. There's actually several different opinions about Charoshet HaGoyim. We don't know exactly where it is. This map follows one opinion. There's another opinion that puts it a little bit further north, but it's in the same general area. What's the first thing you notice when you see that we have a king? The enemy is called Yavin Melech Kenan Asher Malach BeChatzor, and his Sar Tzava, his general, lives in Charoshet HaGoyim. What's strange, yeah?
They're not so close.
They're nowhere near each other. Not only are they not so close, in today's terms, it would take about an hour and a half, maybe an hour and a quarter, to drive between the two places. If anybody learns Sefer Yoshua and remembers it, you may also have another question about Yavin Melech Kenan Asher Malach B'Chatzor. Is there anyone here who learned Sefer Yoshua and remembers it and knows what I'm talking about? Okay, then let's take a quick look. Take a look at Yoshua Perek. Yeshua Perek, Yud Aleph. Just read to yourself Psukim Yud Aleph through Yud Dalid Tedvav. Now tell me what's the problem here.
He's dead.
First of all, Yavin seems to be dead. More importantly, Chatzor doesn't exist. This is the book of Shoftim, right? Yeshua conquered Chatzor and destroyed it. It's the only city that was destroyed. That's what it says here. So only Chatzor was Rosh Kol HaMamlachot HaElah. It was the most important Canaanite city in the north, and as a symbol, Yoshua burned it to the ground. Now look more carefully. You said you're learning Sefer Bereishit. Did you start from the beginning of the Sefer? Not from the beginning, like from Parsha Bereishit?
Parts of it. We're skipping around.
Okay, so there's a Rashi on the Pasuk, the Ha'adam Yada et Chava Ishto. Rashi points out that there's two ways in Biblical Hebrew of saying the past, right? Past tense, a simpler way of saying that Pasuk would be Vayeda Ha'adam et Chava Ishto, right? And Rashi tells us there that in Biblical Hebrew there's a difference between Vayeda and the Ha'adam Yada. Vayeda is what they call in English simple past. And the Ha'adam Yada means what we call in English past perfect. Right? It means you're describing, in English you would say, he or Vayomer would be he said, Vehu Amar would be he had said, even previously. And with that, we now understand, if you look carefully, he's not called Yavin Melech Kenan. I'm sorry, Melech Hatzor. What's he called? Yavin Melech Kenan. Asher malach b'chatzor. Okay? Who had ruled in Chatzor. It's a machloket of the Mefarshim. You also said, somebody over here said that Yavin seems to be dead. Some say maybe he actually wasn't dead. Maybe the king himself survived. Or maybe the king was dead and this is a later generation. Maybe his son or grandson. Or great-grandson. Which probably seems more likely based on the timing here. And he's not the king of Chatzor. He's Melech Kenan Asher Malach B'Chatzor. In other words, what we're talking about here is Melech Chatzor is kind of like an honorary title, right? He's no longer the king of Chatzor. Chatzor doesn't exist. Chatzor has been conquered by Bnei Yisrael a generation or two ago. So Chatzor doesn't exist. Who is he the king of? He's the king of the remnants of the Canaanites. And he retains perhaps the honorary, remember the Holy Roman Empire you learned in high school history? What did your teacher tell you? It wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, and it wasn't an empire, right? Okay, but why do they call it the Holy Roman Empire? They wanted to remember the great Roman Empire and kind of like, you know, it's like an honorary thing, right? So what we have here are the remnants of the Canaanites. This connects back to the message at the end of Sefer Yoshua, in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, about how they didn't finish the job of conquering Canaan. And so he doesn't actually live in Chatzor. So where do you think he does live? Well, I know where his Sartzava is, and his Sartzava is in Charoshet HaGoyim. Okay? Now, if you look on this map, you see where it says Nachal Kishon. Nachal Kishon flows through a valley. You can see here on this topographical map, there's mountains here. Okay, this is the mountains of the Shomron. Okay, this is the mountains of the Shomron. And these up here are the mountains of the Galil. And in between the Shomron and the Galil, and this is Har Carmel over here, there's this valley called Emek Yisrael. Okay? And it seems that the remnants of the Canaanites had made their way over there, and they created like an enclave in that area. And if we look at the next pasuk, we'll understand why specifically in that area. Okay? So, Vayim Kareim Hashem B'yad Yavim Melech Canaan Hashem Malach B'chitzat Zor B'sar Tzvon Sisra V'yoshev B'chorosh L'Aguyim V'yitz'aku B'nei Yisrael El Adonai Ki Tshame Od Rechev Barzelo V'hu Lachatze B'nei Yisrael B'chozka Yisrim Shana. They cried out to Hashem because he has 900 Rechev Barzel, iron chariots. You understand what a chariot is? What would we call that in modern terms? A tank. This is exactly what it is. It's an armored vehicle, right? Pulled by horses, but it's made out of metal, so even if you shoot arrows at it, they just basically bounce right off. He has 900 tanks, in addition to foot soldiers. Bnei Israel didn't have that weapon. All they had was swords. Okay? And now we understand also why they gathered specifically in this area. Okay, that huge wide valley is very, very useful for tents. Okay, they can patrol. This is a major international roadway, and basically what the Canaanites have done is they've managed to create a force that basically now is rebelling against Bnei Israel. And not only have they rebelled, but they're actually oppressing, right? Because they control the roads, they've cut off the tribes of the south from the tribes in the north, and they're basically oppressing the people. And this is so Bnei Israel cry out to Hashem. Okay, now we have the background. And according to the cycle, we're supposed to get a shofet now, right? But we don't exactly get a shofet, we get a shofetet, right? Udvora, Ishanavia, Eshet Lapidot. Interesting what that expression means, Eshet Lapidot. Let's assume it means that her husband's name was Lapidot, which is what many of the Farshim said. Might mean something else, but let's just work with that. V'hi shofta et Yisrael ba'etahi. Okay. So we have this woman. First of all, we're told that she's a Neviah, which is not true of the other Shoftim, at least not all of them, maybe not any of them. Right? The other Shoftim who had, right, for example, Gideon. When Hashem came to Gideon, he sent a Malach. He didn't have a direct communication. Dvorah is called a Neviah. So she's a Neviah and a Shofetet. And there's something very unusual here, in the sense that we have a woman as a Shofetet. Now, that's unusual on two levels. First of all, the very notion that a woman can be a shofetet, halachically became the source of a whole in the Gemara Sanhedrin, I believe. It's in Sanhedrin. Simple understanding of the halacha is that a woman is psula le'idut, even. She can't, in most cases, can't even give testimony in front of a court and certainly can't be the judge. And Tosfot on the spot says, what do you mean? We have Tzvora, and that begins a whole topic of conversation in halacha and whatever it is. Okay, so that's not for now, but we have something unusual here. But we're not only talking about a judge in a courtroom. Remember, the Shoftim of Sefer Shoftim are not judges only in the classic sense of judges. What's the major message of Sefer Shoftim? There's a pasuk that appears three times at the end of the Sefer, one of them being the very last pasuk in the Sefer. Anyone know what it is? Bayamim Ahem, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, Isha Yashar Be'Nav Yaseh. The message of Sefer Shoftim is that we had a period of time where there was no king. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu was a king. Yoshua was a king. Even if they didn't go by that term, that's how they functioned. And of course, Sefer Shmuel is going to talk about how we start to have real kings, Shaul and then David. But we have this period of time without a king, and the message of Sefer Shoftim is how terrible things are when you don't have a king. Right? Isha Yashar Be'Nav Yaseh. Parenthetically, that's the message of Sefer Shoftim, how terrible things are when you don't have a king. The message of Sefer Malachim is how terrible things are when you do have a king and all the damage the kings do. That's one of the major themes, when I said before about politics. Major themes running through. And the question is, are we supposed to have a king? We're not supposed to have a king. It's a machloket. It sounds like even in the Tanakh itself, major machloket Rishonim, and a lot to talk about, not for now. Okay, but we're in Sefer Shoftim. Sefer Shoftim is trying to tell us how bad things are when you don't have a king. And the Shoftim, therefore, are the closest thing we have to a king. Right? They're not kings in the sense that they're just kind of ad hoc. They kind of spring into action. There was one Shofet who had the opportunity to become a king. That's Gideon. Right? The people came to him, they said, we want you basically to be a king. And he said, I'm not going to do it. Whether that was the right decision or the wrong decision is part of that whole discussion. But the Shoftim are the closest thing we have to a king. And therefore, finding a woman in this position, who's essentially acting sort of like a king, or the closest thing to it anyway, is even more unusual. Are there any other women in Tanakh who are queens? Not queens in the sense of Esther, who's the wife of the king, but queens in the sense of a female king. Are there any others? Ataliah is the only one. Izebel was the wife of the king. Right? Izebel had a lot of influence, but she wasn't the king. Ataliah was, but that only proves the point. Ataliah was an evil woman who became king by killing off all of her own grandchildren, except for the one that she missed, right? Yoash. And, right? The only other example, maybe, is Malkat Shva, who it's not 100% clear who she was, and she seemed somewhat from somewhere in Arabia or Africa. And okay, but she's not from us, right? So this is, as Chazal would say, Omer Dorshen, right? What does it mean that suddenly we get a Shofetet instead of a Shofet, that we get a woman in a role that this is the only time we see a woman in a role like this, right? What does that mean? You tell me. Yeah?
No one else was fit for the role.
Okay, so what do you mean by that? No one else was fit for the role, meaning?
Meaning it was a
There just didn't happen to be any men possible, and she was the best person for the job.
Perhaps.
And if we read it that way, therefore, the fact that she's a woman is kind of like a curiosity, you know, like a interesting tidbit, maybe creates halachic questions, but it's not really relevant to the story, if we read it that way, right?
Perhaps.
Or maybe it is relevant just to show you how bad things were, that there's not a single man, so we have to find a woman. That is one way to read it. I'm going to argue, though, that I think that's incorrect. Because, as we're going to see, the text, including Dvorah herself, keeps drawing attention to the fact that she's a woman. The message here, you could spin this and say, oh, this is the message, right? Gender's not really that important. It doesn't matter. All that's important is the best person for the job. I don't think that's what the Navi's saying here. I think, as we're going to see, first of all, Dvorah repeatedly draws attention to the fact that she's a woman. And not only that, she's not the only woman in the story. There's at least two other important women in the story. Well, and if we have time, we'll see that there's a couple other women who stick their head into it and yet their voice is heard also. Okay? So there's something going on here about female leadership that I think is coming out of here. And let's try to see what it is. Okay. So, he yoshevet tachat tomer Dvorah ben harama uvein betel bahar Ephraim v'yalu eile b'nei Yisrael ha-mishpat. She set herself up with like a courthouse under a palm tree. Ben betel uvein harama bahar Ephraim. Take a look at the map and see where that is. This is going to be relevant to our story also. Okay, this is in the area of Shevet Binyamin. It's called Har Ephraim. If you flip the map for a second, just so you can see. Okay, Binyamin, Ephraim, Menashe. Okay, and then here the same area. You see Har Tavor? Har Tavor is, that's like a landmark that can help you link the two maps up together. Okay, so, and you can even see Ramah and Beit El on this map also. Okay, so Ramah and Beit El are in Shevet Binyamin in the area known as Har Ephraim. Because Binyamin and Ephraim is basically one geographic region. And Menashe also, part of Menashe. Okay. Now, we better speed up a little bit. She then sends a message. Vatishlach v'tikra levarak ben avino mikedesh Naftali. Just take a look at where Kedesh Naftali is. Okay? So we have our protagonists now. We have Charoshet HaGoyim, which is where Sisra is based. We have his... He's working for Yavin Melech Kenan, who isn't in Chatzor, right? Who's probably somewhere near Charoshet HaGoyim as well. We have, so that's the king and the general on one side, and the king and the general on the other side is Dvorah, who's based in Ramah Beit El, and Barak in Kedesh Naphtali, and she sends him with the following message. Lechu mashachta behar tavor, velakachta imcha 10,000 ish. I want you to get 10,000 men from the tribes of Naphtali and Zvulun. We'll talk about why those tribes in a few minutes. And I want you to take them up to the top of Har Tavor. And I'm going to bring Sisra and all of his army to you, and you're going to defeat them. Now, the real way to do this would be to go to the top of Har Tavor. The real way to do it would be to hike to the top of Har Tavor, or at least to drive up and hike down, which is what I often do with groups. But unfortunately, we can't do that today. I also, if I had more time and the equipment, I'd pull out Google Earth, and I'd try to give you, and that's not a bad substitute if you can't actually hike it, but I didn't want to spend time on that either. So for now, trust me, and you can go check this out on Google Earth yourself if you'd like. It's really cool. Har Tavor is a very steep mountain, very steep. And it's at the edge of Emek Israel. Basically, it's surrounded on all sides by the valley. It's like a mountain by itself, and very, very steep. And it has kind of a flat top also. So it's a perfect place for her to bring, for Barak to bring his troops. Okay, and he's going to bring them up to the top of the mountain. And what she says is, then Sisra is going to find out about this, and he's going to bring his army to Nachal Kishon, okay, which is in the valley. And basically, he's not going to charge. Sisra is not going to try to climb the mountain. First of all, his chariots are useless. They can't get up the mountain. And even if he sends his men up on foot, first of all, he loses the advantage of his chariots. And second of all, they're going to have to climb up this really steep mountain where the enemy is like shooting arrows at them and throwing rocks at them. That's a disaster. He's not going to do that. Which means that it's a perfect Shetach Kinus, we call it today. It's a perfect staging ground. Barak can assemble his army on the top. And Barak's going to get to decide when the battle starts. Right? Because Sisera is just going to wait for him. On the other hand, and again, you have to imagine yourself, I stand with groups on the top of Har Tavor looking down and picture 900 chariots down there. At some point, you're going to have to go down. And when you go down, it's a suicide mission. 10,000 men with swords against 900 chariots and who knows how many tens of thousands of foot soldiers. It's crazy. But Devorah tells him, you're going to win the war. And remember, she has double authority here. She's the Shofetet, so this is coming essentially from the king, but she's also in the Viyah. Right? This is coming from the real king. She says, don't worry about it. You're going to win the war. Just do what I say and you're going to win the war. And what's his response, Barak? Vayomer leha Barak, pasuk chet, im telchi imi vahalachti, v'im lo telchi imi lo elech. What's her message to him? I'm sorry, what's his message to her? If you come with me, I'll go. And if you won't come with me, I won't go. What does he warn her there for? What's she going to do? Here, the fact that she's a woman is significant, right? What's she going to do on the battlefield with a sword? Even today, maybe women are in combat roles. Even today, not so much. But back then, what's her role here exactly? She told him what to do. He's the general. He's going to do the military strategy. She's the Shofetet. She's busy with people coming to her for judgment in Beit El, or Ramah, wherever she is, Bein Beit El, Bein Ramah. What does he need her for?
Yeah. I think it could be like the same idea of Moshe Rabbeinu being there when they're fighting Amalek.
Okay. He wants her there to represent the fact that Hashem is with them, right? Yeah?
And the role of the Urim Bitumim, meaning she's in the Yah, she can give them information.
Okay, she can give advice if necessary, right? Okay. Yeah?
One aspect of a Jewish king is supposed to be that they're leading the charge. So if she's playing this role of king, then she should also be willing to risk herself.
Okay. And take a look at the geography, and do you think that might have something to do with it also? Look at where Barak is. He's in Kedesh Naphtali. She told him, take 10,000 men to the top of Har Tavor, and I'm going to have Sisera, meaning God, is going to cause Sisera. He's going to cause him to do it because it's going to make sense. That's exactly what Sisera should do from a military perspective. And there's going to be a battle. And I told you that those men are going to be standing up there, looking down and understanding that they're being sent on what appears to be a suicide mission. And Devorah sent him a message, Hashem is with you, go do it. And look where she is. And does this have anything to do with that, perhaps? Right? He's got to get, even if Barak himself, the Mepharshim question whether it was Barak himself who wanted the encouragement or if he felt his men would need it. Right? It's one thing for you to be here with us, coming down the mountain with us into a death trap and telling us, I'm the Nevi'ah, trust me. It's something else for you to be sitting under your palm tree. Understand, from Beit El to Har Tavor today is about a 2-hour drive in a car. In those days, it's a 2 days walk or something like that. I don't know exactly, something. So you're going to sit there under your palm tree in safety and tell us to risk our lives? I can't get 10,000 men to agree to do that. If you're here with us and you're next on the line too, then they'll come. I need you here. And I need you here because you're the Nevi'ah. And what's her response? Vatomer, pasuk tev, Vatomer haloche lechima. Okay, I'll come. Ephes just realized, ki lo tihye tifartecha ala derech asher ata holech, ki biyad isha yimkor Adonai et Sisera. Just realize that if I come, lo tihye tifartecha ala derech asher ata holech, you will not get the credit, the glory, for the path that you're walking down. Ki biyad isha yimkor Hashem et Sisera. Because everyone's not going to say, if I sit at home, you're going to be the great hero who led his troops into victory, and Barak is going to get all the credit. But if I come, then in the end they're going to say, it was a woman. Which woman is she talking about here? There's at least two options. She could be talking about herself. They're going to say, he needed her here. She must be the one who won the way. He couldn't do anything without that lady with him. Another possibility is Yael, who's the one who's ultimately going to kill Sisera. We'll talk about her in a minute. Some of the more Mepharshim understand it as far as some understand it as Yael. Some say, and to me this seems like it might be the real shot, she's talking about both. right? And again, we're starting to see what I was talking about here. It's not, by the way, interesting curiosity, she happens to be a woman, and who cares? It's the most important person for the job. The fact that she's a woman, she herself is drawing attention to that. She says, you sure you want me there? They're going to say that a woman won this battle. You're not going to get the glory. And what's Barak's, she's playing on his male ego here, right? What's Barak's response? Vatakom dvora vatelechim Barak kedsha. What does he respond? He doesn't respond at all. He seems to be completely fine with that. Right? No problem. I need you. I won't get the glory, I won't get the glory. We need to win the war. It'll be a woman, it'll be a woman. It's an interesting question. Why she egged him on like that, and whether his response was appropriate or not. There's a number of Gemaras that discuss this, and to me it's not 100% clear what Chazal were trying to say, and I don't get the sense that they all agreed. There is at least one Gemara that seems to criticize Dvorah a little bit. There's one Gemara that I saw that sounds like it's criticizing Barak, that what does he need her to come, he should, you know, whatever. And a different Gemara that sounds like it's praising Barak. I'm not sure, though. They're all somewhat ambiguous. If we could have spent the time on that, I could have brought the sources, but I wanted to focus on something else. So I'm not sure. But and I'm not sure what she was trying to do. Was she trying to talk him out of asking her to come, or was she trying to get him to say that he doesn't mind? Like, was she hoping for this reaction? By the way, there's also a whole midrashic idea that a number of sources in Chazal have Dvorah and Barak married to each other. Her husband's name was Lapidot. Lapid is a torch, and Barak is lightning, and it sort of seems similar, and they're midrashim. So there's a lot going on here that we could talk about. Okay, but let's put that aside, and let's just say that, better or for worse, right or wrong, Barak seems totally okay with the fact that the credit is going to go to a woman. What he wants is to win the war, and he feels he needs her there. She comes. Okay? In the interest of time, I'm going to skip the rest of this parak because I want to look a little bit at the Shira. But let me just summarize, okay, what I assume many people know. Maybe one pasuk we should read. The actual order to start the battle comes from Dvorah, not from Barak. I mean, it comes from him to his men. But she's the one who decides. Or God decides and she's the one who communicates it, right? Pasuk Yudalid, right? Yeah, let's already read from Yud Gimel. Vayazek Sisra et kol rechbo chamiot rechet barzel. He brings his whole army, 900 chariots. That kol ha'am esher yitom echaroshet avim ha'machal kishon. Vatom et vorah barak kum. Arise. Ki zeh hayom asher natan l'adonai Sisra b'yadecha. Halo Adonai yatsa lefanecha. Go, lead your men into battle. God himself is going in front of you. Vayered barak mehar tavor v'aseret alafim ish acharav. So he takes his people down, charging into what appears to be sudden death, certain death, whatever. And it says, Vayahom Adonai et Sisra, v'tarecheb et kol ha'machaneh lefi cherev lefnei barak, v'yered Sisra me'al ha'merkavah v'yanos b'raglav. Something goes wrong from Sisra's perspective, and everything starts going wrong, his forces start to lose, and Sisra himself shows himself to be a coward. He deserts the battlefield, runs away. Winds up in the tent of Yael, Eshet Chever HaKeni, who understand is not from Bnei Israel. She's not part of us. She's from another nation, the Keni. They're descendants of Yitro. They were sort of neutral, it seems, or so he thought. They had good relations with Sisra. He thought that she was on their side. Apparently not. And she invites him into her tent, and he asks for water. She gives him milk. He falls asleep, and she takes the tent peg, and boom. And Barak comes chasing him, and she comes out of her tent and says, I think I know who you're looking for. And in fact, Biyad Hashem Natan, Biyad Isha Natan Hashem at Sisra. Okay? What happened on the battlefield? Again, if I had more time, I'd go through and we kind of discern this. The text doesn't exactly say, but there's enough hints in the text that seem to tell us what was going on here. It doesn't have to be a completely supernatural miracle. It seems that what happened was a sudden and perhaps unexpected rainstorm. There's a number of psukim, both in here a little bit, and also in Perek Hay, and also Josephus, by the way, records in his Antiquities of the Jews an old tradition that that's what happened. It seems that was passed down, that there was a sudden rainstorm. Probably I can tell you that what happened is that, as I assume you know, in Eretz Yisrael, the climate is such it rains in the winter, it doesn't rain in the summer. In late spring, it doesn't rain very often. Let's say April, May, even early June, it doesn't rain very often, but it can. And when it does, it's often a very sudden, I mean, today we have usually know about it because of meteorology, but like, you know, it can be somewhat unexpected and a huge downpour. And when that happens, the valley becomes muddy and the chariots become useless. And it sounds like that's what happened, right? So Dvorah was in Viyah. She told Barak, Hashem is with you. She said to him, Hashem yetzei lefanecha. And literally, the skies opened up. And that sounds like what happened, and Sisra ran away. Okay. That's Perek Dalet. Now, Perek Hay is the Shira. Now, in the Shira, we have a parallel here to Shirat Hayam. Right? This is actually the Haftarah that we read in Parshat B'Shalach. There we had, after Paro, after his army was defeated by the water, right? And we have Az Yashir Moshe Uvnei Yisrael. Moshe sings and Bnei Yisrael respond. And here also, there's a song of praise to Hashem. Who's leading the song and who's responding? Atashar Dvorah Uvarak Ben Avinon. Right, Az Yashir Moshe Uvnei Yisrael. Again, Dvorah is the leader, and Barak is responding, and they sing this song together. And many people think that Perek Dalet tells the story, and Perek Hay is just the poetic song. That's a mistake. There's information in Perek Hay as well. We don't have time, and it's also very difficult. It's very poetic language, and some of the things, it's not 100% clear what they mean. We don't have time to go through all of it. I want to point to just a few key aspects of the Shira to try to understand what Dvorah's message is. Okay? So, let's first look at, is there a marker? Yes, there is. Okay, I'll use the board in a minute. First of all, I want to look at the following pasuk. And let's take a look at pasuk Vav. Okay, Bimei Shamgar ben Anat, Bimei Yael, Chadlu Arachot, Behochei Netivot Yelchu Arachot Atal Kalot. Here Dvorah is setting the background for what happened. In the days of Shamgar ben Anat already, who was the previous Shofet, and in the days of Yael, fascinating, when she talks about her own generation, she doesn't say Bimei Shamgar or Bimei Dvorah, she said Bimei Yael, right? But already in those generations, the roads became empty. Why? Because the Canaanites were controlling the roads, and Bnei Yisrael couldn't really travel, and they were oppressed. The roads became empty. Chadlu Prazon BeYisrael Chaderu. And people stopped living in open villages because it was too dangerous. They had to live behind fences. Sound familiar? They had to live behind fences. They moved into the walled cities. And that was the situation. Ad Shakamti Dvorah, Shakamti Aim BeYisrael. Until I arose, Dvorah. And what does she call herself? Aim BeYisrael. Again, she's drawing attention specifically to her femininity here. She's calling herself, and what aspect of being a woman? Specifically, she calls herself the mother of the people, right? The mother of Yisrael. And I think that there's a message here, which I'll try to pull out in a second, what the message is here. But as I said before, I don't think the fact that she's a woman here is incidental. I think there's a message here. I once said that these two prakim are the most feminist prakim in the whole Tanakh. And the response I got is, yeah, well, that's not saying much. So that may be true. But I think there's a very powerful message here. I want to, in just a few minutes we have, I want to try to uncover what it is. Okay? So she refers to herself. Again, we already saw. She says to Barak, you sure? It's going to be a woman. And he doesn't care. And we see that there's already two women that were involved in this victory, both in ways that we wouldn't expect. Dvorah acting as a king, where we wouldn't or Shofetet, where we wouldn't expect a woman. And then Yael essentially acting as a soldier, in a way that we wouldn't expect, right? We have women stepping into these roles. I want to focus specifically at this point on a group of psukim, starting from Pasuk Yud Dalet. Dvorah goes and lists, and for this now, turn over the page to the backside, please. I want you to look at the Shvatim. And Dvorah specifically mentions a number of the Shvatim, and she talks about which Shvatim came to participate in the battle. Now, as far as we know, from Perek Dalet, there were only two Shvatim involved in the battle, which were Zvulun and Naphtali. But as we'll see, it seems to be more complicated. Because it seems that more Shvatim were involved, more than what we were told in Perek Dalet. One of the things I love to do from the top of Har Tabor is to try to figure out what exactly the battle plan was, and it seems it was more complex than what we were told, and there's one particular theory that's not my own that I like to share, but we'll leave that out for now. What I do want to show you is that there are some Shvatim that she praises for their bravery for going and joining the battle, and other Shvatim that she criticizes. Okay, so let's just... it would be nice if this worked. Is there one? Okay. Thanks.
We have some teachers.
What was that?
Teachers have markers on.
Yeah. Okay. So the check mark will be the good guys, and the X mark will be the ones that she criticizes. Okay. And again, it's very, very poetic, but let's try to understand. Okay. So pick it up from Pasuk Yudal. Mini Ephraim, Shosham ba'amalek. Acharecha bin Yamin ba'amamecha. Okay, so she praises Ephraim and bin Yamin, who seems to have been involved in the battle also, even though we didn't hear about them. Mini Machir. Anyone know who Machir is? It's a hard one. Good. Very good. You know that from Bamidbar? Very good. Machir is one of the families of Menashe. Now, Menashe was a very big shevet that already had two nachalot, right? Chatzi Menashe is Bechlal on the eastern side of the river. What's important to understand is that Machir is the part of Menashe that's in the northern Shomron, let's say the area north of Shechem, okay? So at least that part of Menashe was involved. Yardu Mechokik, Uzvulun Moshe Shevet Sofer. Zvulun we already knew about, okay? So she praises them. V'sarai b'Yisachar im Dvora. Seems that Yisachar was also involved. Yisachar came Barak be'emek shulach b'ragla. They followed Barak with their legs into battle. Okay? So far we have five shvatim. We haven't even heard about Naphtali yet. We already knew about Naphtali. He's going to show up in the later pasuk, so I'll put him here too. We have six shvatim, it seems, that she praises for coming to the battle and for being willing to fight against Sisra. And now she gets to the Shvatim that she criticizes. Biflagot Reuven Gedolim Chikikelev. Reuven has a lot of deep thoughts. Lama Yashavta Bena Mishpataim Lishmoa Srikot Adarim. Why were you sitting around listening to the sheep making their noises? Liflagot Reuven Gedolim Chikikelev. You had lots and lots of deep discussions. It sounds like what she's saying is that Reuven got a call to come and join the battle, and they said, we have to talk about this, we have to have a meeting, we have to have a conference, we have to discuss. And they had all these meetings and discussions while the sheep were busy doing their thing, and somehow they never managed to finish the discussions and actually show up, right? Buried it in committee. That's more or less what it is. That's what it sounds like. So unlike these Shvatim who came, she criticizes Reuven. Gilad... Who's Gilad? Gilad is not a Shevet, is it? Gilad is a geographic region. Anyone know where it is, Gilad? It's in Eiver HaYarden, on the eastern side. It's the area where Gad lives. Okay, so she's referring to them by their area, but she's talking about Shevet Gad. Okay, they live just north of Reuven on the eastern side, Eiver HaYarden. Gilad, be'Eiver HaYarden Shachem, he sat there on the other side of the river. So God didn't come either. V'dan, lama yagur aniyot. Dan was so busy with their ships that they didn't bother to come. Asher yashav l'chof yamin. Asher was sitting by the seashore. V'al mifratzav yishkon. But Zvulun, am cheref nafsho lamut. Zvulun was willing to expose himself to death. We already said, Zvulun and Naphtali were the ones on top of the mountain who ran straight into the enemy forces. They risked their lives. So they praised them. V'Naphtali, al merome sadeh. Okay. Let's look at this. I want to try to understand what happened, and I want to just try to understand what Dvorah's message is. We heard that she told two Shvatim. She told Barak to take two Shvatim up to the top of Har Tavor. It seems that the battle plan was more complicated and that other Shvatim were involved. And again, if I was up there in the mountain, I'd show you where maybe there was an ambush set up and whatever. It doesn't matter for now. But the point is, it wasn't only Zvulun and Naphtali that came to the battle. That's clear. Some of the tribes did, and some of the tribes didn't. Let's start with those who didn't. I'd like you to look at the map and ask if maybe based on the geography you can suggest why those Shvatim that didn't come, why didn't they come? By the way, one major Shevet is not mentioned here at all. Yehuda, not even mentioned. We'll get back to that in a minute. But from those who didn't come, can you suggest to me maybe why?
Can I do who did come in order to explain why?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, because I think the top ones are the ones that are involved, like Naphtali, Zvulun, Issachar, Menasha, are like directly by Harzabor.
Okay, let's put an asterisk near them. The ones that are very close to the battle site, definitely Zvulun, Naphtali, and Issachar. Maybe also Menasha. I'll put a circle around it because Menasha, you can't see it on the map. They are nearby, but they're up on a mountain.
And she is in Ephraim, Binyamin.
Yeah, fair. Okay, so we'll come back to that second point in a minute. But before we get to that second point, what about these guys?
Reuben and Gad are on the other side of the Yarden.
Mm-hmm.
Dan is all the way by the water. And Asher...
Northwest, also by the water, but further up.
Right, further
and
up.
Therefore what?
So Asher really should have come. Dan maybe.
What? Well, she seems to feel they all should have come. Tell me why they should come, and tell me why they shouldn't come. If Reuven was having this big meeting, what were they saying? Tell me the two sides.
Should we go or should we not go?
Why should we? Why shouldn't we?
Because we're not a part of it. It doesn't impact us. And that's the whole problem with Reuven and Gad being on the other side.
Okay. And that's true also for Dan and Asher.
Yeah.
Right? In other words, I feel bad. Why should they go?
It's their people.
It's your brothers, right? Yeah. I feel bad for them. Maybe I'll send a check. But I should send my son into battle? To risk his life or somebody else? Should they send their son into battle to risk his life? Why?
They promised that they wouldn't.
Okay, first of all, Reuven Gad specifically. But
it's not someone else. It's all people.
Oh. And who sees that more than anyone else? A mother. What does a mother want more than anything? She wants her children to be together. Right? She says, they're your brothers. So she's emphasizing it with a motherly image. But this is also the major message of Sefer Shoftim. A parallel, or a corollary, I should say, to not having a king, is the question, are we a nation? Are we a bunch of Shvatim? And this is where you see the difference. Look, we can see it today. Okay, there was a terrible, terrible, horrific attack on Simchat Torah. Who was affected by it? The kibbutzim of Otef Aza, right? I live in Gush Etzion. I didn't even know what was going on. I have this thing. I like to get. I wake up very early in the morning. One of my most pleasurable times of the week is early Shabbos morning, about 5:30 in the morning in the summertime. I take a cup of coffee and I go for a stroll in the streets of Alon Shvut. It's quiet. I woke up that morning on Simchas Torah. I heard what I thought was thunder. It was weird. They weren't predicting rain. I looked up in the sky, no clouds. I said, that's weird. I didn't really think about it. I was hearing bombs from far away. Until someone came into shul, I had no idea. And there are people that live much further away. Right? Today there are soldiers in the Gaza Strip, in Gaza City, risking their lives. Do they all live in Otef Aza? A guy from Afula, does he say, what are you sending me for? I'm from Afula. What has this got to do with me? Of course not. Why? Why is a guy from Afula willing to go and risk his life to save some kibbutznik who lives outside of Aza? Because we're a nation. It's not about me. We're one people. That's what Dvorah was telling them. So, fine, these Shvatim, maybe Menashe also, I understand why they came. These guys, unfortunately, didn't. But yeah, what's your name?
Elisheva.
Noticed that Ephraim and Binyamin did come, even though they're also far away. But what they had, maybe, was Dvorah. And if that's correct, what I'm saying is Dvorah's message was that if we're going to survive, if we're going to succeed, we have to remember that we're one people. We're not Shvatim. We're one Am. You need your mother to remind you that you're all brothers. Unfortunately, her message wasn't heard by all the people. But maybe it seems that at least some of the people listened to her. Who are the ones that she had the most direct influence with? Her Shevet, her neighbors in Ephraim and Menashe. The people who maybe she had more of an impact on because they knew her. Yehuda, by the way, she doesn't even bother. She doesn't even bother criticizing Yehuda. And that already has to do with a something that has much earlier roots and much later roots, and the split between Yehuda and Yisrael, and but it's telling that she doesn't even bother mentioning Yehuda. Like, there was not even a Havamina, it sounds like, that Yehuda would come, which is terrible, right? But at least her own people, Binyamin, Ephraim, and Menashe, it seems that they did listen to her, and they showed up, and maybe that was enough. At least for this, it was enough to win the war. So what I think is coming out of this is two things. I gave a shorter version of this, and much more, it was for high school girls. So I you know, it wasn't as in-depth. But I gave a version of this shiur yesterday in a high school, and I made the mistake of putting on top of the page female wartime leadership. Right? So then when I tried to get them to, so they all knew where I was going with it. So I changed on this one to Milchemet HaKishon, right? But I think that is the message here. I think, I don't think it's by accident that Dvorah was a woman, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it, but who's the other woman in the story? Aim Sisera, right? Who's portrayed as the alter ego, what are you, the
foil.
The foil, that's sort of the literary word, right? The opposite of Dvorah. She also has some Canaanite women who are cheering her on, so to speak. We don't have time to get into her. But the point is the fact that I think there's a strong message here. And there are those, by the way, I didn't see this in any classical commentaries, but I've seen a lot of modern commentaries. That, what's your name, I'm sorry?
Zahava.
That take this along the way. Oh, it shows you how terrible things were that we needed a woman as a leader. I don't know. I don't see that in the text, and I don't see that in the classical portion. I'm seeing something else. I'm seeing a message saying that what we needed at this point was the leadership of a woman, particularly a motherly woman, right? Because that's the message. Dvorah's message is that we can only succeed if we are united, and if we all stand together, we'll defeat our enemies. And if we're divided, if we say, well, it's not my problem, then everything falls apart. Her message didn't get through to all the people. It did get through at least to some of the people, and at least at this point it was enough to win the war. And if I have another couple of minutes, I probably don't even need to make the connection, but I'll do it anyway. Because, look, what happened on Simchat Torah was mind-bogglingly devastating for all of us. And I think we're all still processing, and it's going to take a long time to really understand the level of, I mean, let's put it on the table, absolute collapse of our intelligence and our military defenses. I remember, you know, on Simchat Torah, the, you know, news started trickling in and rumors, and some people had their phones on, people in the army, whatever. My son told me he heard a rumor that Hamas terrorists invaded and conquered a kibbutz. I said, what are you talking about? That's not possible. And then I turned on my phone right after Yontif, and at that point, things were still in the midst of it, they said estimates of 100 dead. I said, 100? That can't be. But quickly, Halavai was 100, and Halavai was 8 kibbutz, right? Now look, and it's so, okay, there'll be a commission of inquiry, and what the army, who's responsible, whatever, that has to be, those questions have to be asked, they will be asked. That's not my issue right now. From a spiritual perspective, something like this is so unexplainable that it's clear that it's right from Hashem. It's clear to me. This was direct from God. The same way our successes can't be explained when our failures can't be explained, it means it's direct from Hashem. And you have to ask yourself, what does Hashem want from us? Now, it's always dangerous to try to say, you know, this happened because of this sin or that sin. You always have to be very careful with that. Especially if what usually happens is, usually when people come along and say, you know, God did this because, it's usually other people's sins that they're identifying and say, it's because you did this wrong and you did that wrong. But at the very least, we are supposed to look at ourselves. And with appropriate disclaimers that we don't really know, I'm not the only one who's saying this. Rarely has it been clearer to me what Hashem wants from us. The terrible, terrible divisiveness, the terrible, and the writing was on the wall and we all knew it. You know, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse, and of course, maybe hitting a climax on Yom Kippur in Tel Aviv. And our enemies saw it too. They said it b'pe mele. They said it openly in the press. The Jews are fighting with each other. This is our time to attack. They said it. Nasrallah said it. And the Sinwar said it. And the Iranians said it. If, however, that was the problem, Rav Meidan said this also on a podcast that the Gush put out shortly after the war started. If that was a problem, we've already done tshuva. In an instant. Literally in an instant. My son was in Yerushalayim on Simchat Torah. I have two sons and a son-in-law that were all called up from Miluim. He was there on Simchat Torah. Someone said, you should turn your phone on. You know, things are happening. People are getting called up from Miluim. They got the message. They got in the car on Shabbat on Simchat Torah and they went down there. He told me they were driving 160 kilometers an hour. That's like 110, 120 miles an hour in the right lane. Because the people just ran down there. The army had collapsed. They got themselves together very quickly, Baruch Hashem. The army had collapsed. People just grabbed guns. Whoever knew, they formed ad hoc military units and they went in. We now know, by the way, that Hamas, we have to give it to them. Unfortunately, this was meticulously planned military operation. But they had battle plans. They thought they were going to, they knew that eventually we would push them back. They thought they were going to be in Israel for a month. They had logistic preparations to stay in Israel for a month. And they thought they were going to get as far as Hebron. And the reason they were stopped is because instantly Am Yisrael sprung to action. And people who days earlier had been protesting very viciously, almost physical violence against one or the other. There were even a few incidents of minor physical violence. Thank God it was only minor. Are now sitting shoulder to shoulder in tanks and on guard posts and on the home front and packing boxes and helping and volunteering. And not just in Israel, across the world. Somebody called me up. I heard you're going to Israel. Can you take 6 duffel bags, please? Someone's meeting me at JFK Airport with 6 duffel bags full of donated supplies to take back to Israel. I'm not even sure it's worth the baggage fees to take them. We could probably buy the stuff in it, but I also realize it may not matter. Maybe it's necessary and there are things that they don't have in Israel, and maybe it's just that both the giver and the receiver have to get that message that we're all one people. Let me just close with one final thought. I know I'm a little over time, but the guy before me was 10 minutes over time. So if I'm four minutes over, so you still owe me 6. So let me just say one last thing. I think the message of Devorah here is very, very powerful. Two last things. Number one, if I'm right that this is the message, and if it's dafka the feminine leadership, so as the only man in the room, I'll tell you this is your job, right? If that's in fact, so it's the women's voice that we need here. In the real challenge is going to be not what's going on now. The real challenge is going to be when the war ends and we do win Bezrat Hashem, and we will. What happens after that? And how do we hold on to this unity? And we've seen our enemies in the Gaza Strip and other parts of Eretz Yisrael and around the world have shown their true faces, and we've shown our true face now also. And the question is, how do we hold on to this? How do we make sure we don't go back to the way things were? And I do know also that many people have said to me on this trip that it's so hard to be here far away and everyone feels so connected to Eretz Yisrael. And it's very clear to me that those thoughts are genuine and it's true. And that those feelings are crucial and are very important. There is one aspect of this in which you guys are dafka on the front line. And that's the following. What I'm seeing around the United States and around the world actually is lots and lots of Jews who are not so affiliated, who are suddenly waking up and realizing they're Jews. If for no other reason than they're feeling under attack, or maybe not. I have students, okay, this is Stern, right? But I have students on campus and relatives on campuses around America who sent me videos of pictures of these like pro-Israel demonstrations on campus. It looks pretty clear to me that at least a lot of the kids at those rallies would not have been in a pro-Israel rally a couple months ago, right? But something struck a chord inside them. And this past Friday night, 2 separate people, I've been talking about this a lot wherever I go, 2 separate people told me 2 separate stories about separate individuals that they happen to know, who in both cases they told me this is a person who's completely unaffiliated, who's never been to shul in their life, and has now gone to shul for 2 or 3 weeks in a row, simply because they feel the need to be with other Jews. Maybe even just because they're feeling threatened or not, I don't know. But if that's happening, this is the moment right now that we have to pull these people in, right? We have to figure out how to get them involved. A couple days ago, I was telling people, pick up the phones, think of who you can call, your relative, your coworker, your client, somebody, and say, get on that plane or bus and go to Washington. Okay, so it's too late for the rally in Washington now, but this is the time. Am Yisrael is waking up and realizing Devorah's message. They're realizing that we're one people and we have to be together, and it's all of our responsibility to capitalize on that. And to figure out how we're going to continue to work together and have the important arguments that we dropped that are important, then we will have to pick them up at some point, and how we're going to have those arguments in a better way, so that we can fulfill our mission and win not just the war, but the ultimate purpose of what we're here for. So thank you very much.